Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 9 and 11 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. This hour, how voters of faith see the political moment that we're in. And I don't just mean evangelical voters. I mean voters of all denominations who are influenced by their faith. The family separation issue brought together an unusual coalition of voters and leaders. Mormons, Protestants, evangelicals, and Jewish organizations had fierce criticism for the policy. The Pope condemned the family separation policy from the Vatican. But how are these voters viewing the immigration debate as a whole? Are their sacred texts and religious beliefs guiding their opinions on the issue? And as I said at the beginning, the political moment that we're in as a whole. So as our guests join us today, I'd like you to do some candid thinking on this and call in. Are you finding that your political views on immigration and politics are at odds or aligned with your own religious views and the leaders of your faith community? So as you see the political moment that we're in, I'd like to know where that intersects with your experience as a person of faith. Here's the phone number, 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, and on Twitter at CarrieNPR. One note here. I think you can hear that this isn't a show only for evangelical Christians to call in, because I think a lot of people are influenced by their experience of their faith. And it's top of mind as you're making political decisions and your political perspective. So I want to hear from a lot of different people from many different faiths. I just want you to know that our phone lines are open to everyone. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, and on Twitter at CarrieNPR. Our guest today, Emma Green, is a staff writer for The Atlantic. She's been writing about this. And Emma, it's a pleasure to have you on the show. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Bonnie Christian is with us. She's weekend editor at The Week and author of A Flexible Faith, Rethinking What It Means to Follow Jesus Today. And she's in studio. Bonnie, welcome. It's good to have you here.
It is great to be here.
Emma, we're in a country with, I think, where religion mixes in with politics a lot. So the fact that faith communities would weigh in on an immigration policy is not that unusual. What I thought was remarkable was that many different faiths came together to condemn this family separation issue. And I thought, that doesn't seem to be happening that often anymore. What was your perspective on how that happened?
Certainly, I think the condemnations that we've heard from religious groups, from Jewish groups to Mormon groups, Catholics, Protestants, you name it, they've been unusually united, as you said. We had figures ranging from Reverend Franklin Graham, the son of the late Pastor Billy Graham, who's typically a very strong Trump supporter and very conservative, call the policy of family separation disgraceful, saying that it's terrible to see families ripped apart, all the way to the most liberal end of the religious spectrum, Reformed Jews, liberal Protestant denominations, issuing statements with equal levels of vigor and condemnation. I think the commonality here that perhaps is unusual is this visual that we've seen from the border of children being ripped from their parents, crying, feeling deeply that sense of injustice that families would be split apart just because they approach the border, whether to migrate for a better life or to seek asylum.
You know, Bonnie, I wondered how influential that ended up being in President Trump's decision to sign this order. Again, he didn't need to sign the order, but he did, to stop the family separation. Do you think the coalition of different faiths raised the bar in some ways for him and in a way that usual criticism does not?
Yeah, you know, it's always difficult to divine the mind of Trump, but it certainly seemed to have an effect this time. Some of his comments in the run-up to signing the executive order were on Twitter. He was describing it as a terrible policy, mm-hmm. And of course blaming it on congressional Democrats. But his language about his own policy seemed to suggest that he as well was influenced by some of the public pressure, and perhaps also some of those emotionally affecting images and audio recordings of the children at the border. And so it's hard to say how these things influence him, especially because he can be so changeable. But certainly the breadth of the coalition and the language that we heard from people like Franklin Graham, as Emma mentioned, it seems like it must have had an influence on him because some of these voices have been so hesitant to criticize anything he says or does in the past.
I mean, that's one thing that was remarkable, Emma, that Franklin Graham, who I don't think has openly criticized the president in the entire first term, felt compelled to come out and say something about this. How much do you think that mattered to the president?
So Franklin Graham is an interesting figure. On the one hand, you're right, he tends to be very supportive of President Trump. In general, he has very conservative political and social views. But in some ways, kind of surprisingly, he is a gadfly in this administration. He has been part of gatherings of Trump's evangelical advisors. He certainly had a presence when President Trump has signed religious freedom executive orders. But he's not as closely tied to the White House, nor as frequently in Washington as some other Trump advisors. The person who actually struck me the most was the Reverend Samuel Rodriguez, who is an influential evangelical Hispanic leader, mm-hmm. who's also very close to President Trump. He, in fact, was one of the few clergy who gave a prayer at Trump's inauguration. Yet he was one of the strongest voices to come out, push back against the family separations, and in general seems to be someone who's trying to make change from within as one of Trump's advisors.
Let's take some calls here. If you've just gotten in on the show, it's a conversation about how voters of faith, and I mean all faiths, because I think too often when we talk about faith, we mean evangelical Christians. I want to know, as a person of faith, whatever faith community that you're committed to, how you're seeing the political moment we're in and how you're seeing these individual issues, including immigration and this issue of family separation, how your faith is informing the way you see that, especially if perhaps the texts of your faith say one thing about this, your politics may say another. How do you reconcile that? 800-242-2828-651-227-6000 and on Twitter at Carrie NPR to Nicole in St. Paul. Hey, Nicole. Hi.
Hi. I would like to say, you know, that I am a Christian, and I find the period that we're in to be cringeworthy and dangerous. I think what the evangelical Christians have done with this alignment with Trump and the politicizing of, you know, just certain comments and pastors, you know, coming out, you know, to make all of these comments, you know, Trump has never aligned himself with the Christian faith ever since he's been on TV. He's never referenced God in any way, prayer in any way, until he was running for president. And Obama had so much scrutiny because just merely because he was a black man. But there could be other reasons, you know, maybe because his father was from Africa or, you know, however you want to put it. But I think that the environment that we're in is really dangerous and bad for Christianity all over the world, because what we're doing is we're attaching the faith of God to man's kind of agenda. Mm-hmm. And there are so many scriptures and verses that we can use that support kind of family unity all over the Bible, just as there are those that talk about, you know, anything. We can get, right. We can take one little verse out of the scripture and support our own human goals.
Yeah, Nicole, forgive me for interrupting. We have so many people on the phone lines. I think I have the essence of what you're going to say, and you have two good points to make here. Emma, Nicole said we're seeing an alignment in a way that we haven't before of politics and religion. I'm paraphrasing there. But I think we've seen this for a long time in American politics, which is why Europeans and people from other countries are puzzled by the way we mix religion and politics in this country. What would you say?
Certainly, it's not new that religion and politics in the United States mix. I think that goes back to our founding. But what I do think is interesting to watch right now and consequential ultimately is the kind of division that we're seeing in different religious groups over the appropriate role for politics. For example, at the Southern Baptist Convention's big gathering just a couple of weeks ago, Vice President Pence gave a talk, and there was a pretty significant split among the messengers at the convention. This is a very conservative evangelical denomination. Some people even who support President Trump didn't think it was appropriate. So I think we're going to see the effects of that playing out as we move forward into the Trump era.
Bonnie, I was reading about this, this division within the Southern Baptists, this meeting in Dallas. They called on churches to help and serve immigrant communities. And yet there are plenty of church members and individual churches and individual towns in America who, like President Trump's stance on limiting legal immigration and turning away people who apply for asylum at the border. What do you make of what's going on within a convention like the Southern Baptists?
It's an interesting situation, and I think that oftentimes there's something of a split in terms of a Southern Baptist or someone in a similar religious context may be very eager and willing to help the immigrants and refugees whom they personally encounter and whom they know. They're very eager to help at that personal level. But at the policy level, there's something of a division of, you know, we want to strengthen our borders and limit immigration. And that division makes it difficult, I think, to negotiate this. And I think you're also seeing within the Southern Baptist particularly, but I'm sure other denominations as well, something of a division between some of the leadership and some of the lay level. Mm-hmm. And so Russell Moore of the Southern Baptist Religious and Liberty and Ethics Commission, I may be butchering that name a little bit, but he's been a prominent critic of President Trump and a prominent representative advocating for not doing the family separations and for taking a humane approach to border control. And he's been come under fire by many, many people within his own denomination, while applauded by others as well. And so I think that while there has always been this mixture of religion and politics, as Emma said, we're seeing new fault lines and people are having to think more critically about this. And as much as it can be very painful to watch and to experience, whether you're in those denominations or not, I think it potentially could be a good thing that we're thinking along about these things in a more direct manner.
I was just going to ask that, Emma, whether these are good and constructive moments for churches when there might be division between the leadership and maybe even within congregations, that churches are in this moment and debating things that, you know, that really matter to what it means to be an American and big questions like that. What do you think?
You know, I don't have an opinion whether it's good or bad, just in the sense that I try to stick with analysis rather than offering my own view. But what I will say is that a thing I hear over and over from the most conservative to the most liberal groups I speak with is a sense of frustration, alienation, and exhaustion. And I think that's from people who support President Trump and from people who support President Obama. Just the sense that we have become a totally divided and nasty nation, and sometimes that is also reflected in the communities that matter to people most, their religious communities and their local communities. So I don't know that everyone who's experiencing this division and fracture would necessarily call it constructive, because I think there's a lot of a feeling of tiredness and alienation right now.
Maybe on the outside looking in, Bonnie, we can see that this may be constructive on the other side, but it feels hard, as Emma is saying, in the moment.
Yeah, I think it can be both. And I think even as there's the potential for it to be constructive, that's certainly no guarantee. It certainly could go in a negative direction and just result in more permanent divisions and more permanent loss of fellowship. And so it's maybe too soon to tell, but certainly not too soon to be hopeful that it will move in a positive direction.
Call here from Ahmed in Minneapolis. By the way, if you're getting a busy signal on the phone lines, call us back. I definitely want to hear what you have to say. Ahmed, hey, thanks so much for waiting.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I guess I'm an American Muslim, and in light of today's Supreme Court decision on Muslim ban, I would say that as American Muslims, that I would imagine a lot of conservative American Muslims they would find themselves in a value issues, quote-unquote value issues, closer to the Republican Party.
Mm-hmm.
But they have historically, or essentially for the last probably 16, 17 years, after this George W. Bush's second election, they have been voting closer to, a vast majority have been voting for the Democratic Party because of the, you see how much hate and bigotry and racism and prejudice and Islamophobia that comes out of the Republican Party. And also it just shows that, you know, the pro-life only comes when, pro-life comes only when it comes to the issues of fetus, when it comes to execution of minorities, African-Americans, issues with immigrants separating parents from their children. They do not see that value in the Republican Party anymore.
This is super interesting.
They have been voting with the Democratic Party for the past about 17, 18 years.
Yeah. Hey, thanks so much for the call. That's really interesting. If I caught that right, Bonnie, it's that when we look at our political views, they would naturally align, he's saying, conservative Muslims, they would more align with the Republican Party. But then we have this rhetoric and we have these policies, and that drives a lot of conservative Muslims out of the party. Is this something that you've investigated?
Yeah, I've read statistics to that effect, that before sort of the beginning of the war on terror and the suspicion of Muslims that sort of came with that, especially in, I remember those very early days shortly after 9/11, there was even attacks on Muslim people in America. And then, of course, more recently as well. But before that happened, many Muslims in America were leaning, they were majority GOP voters. And since then, there's been a dramatic shift, just as Ahmed described.
Call here from Liz in Eagan. Hi, Liz. Thank you for waiting.
Hello.
Hi.
I was going to point out, I have worked in Lutheran churches for approximately 15 years doing Christian education, and the biblical mandate is really fairly clear when it comes to separating children and families in particular.
Mm-hmm.
The Bible, Old Testament, New Testament, no matter where you're looking, calls us to care for the refugee, to care for the orphans, to care for the widows. And in the instances in the Bible where family separations occur, it is dictators who are doing it. It is Pharaoh and Herod and people who are universally seen in the Christian tradition as really bad guys. So I have a hard time as a Christian seeing biblical defenses of some really awful things.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm glad that there was a pushback from Sessions' use of claiming the Bible as authority in what they were doing and things like that.
Liz, let me do this. You've given me a moment here. I wanted to play something that Attorney General Jeff Sessions said in front of a large group seeking, I guess, sources from the Bible to support what the administration was doing. And as Liz notes, there was a lot of pushback. Here's what he said.
And I would cite you to the Apostle Paul and his clear and wise command in Romans 13 to obey the laws of the government, because God has ordained the government for his purposes. Orderly and lawful processes are good in themselves. Consistent, fair application of law is in itself a good and moral thing, and that protects the weak. It protects the lawful.
Emma, what happened in the wake of that? That happened late last week.
There were widespread condemnations of those comments from even the most conservative evangelicals, even the United Methodist Church, which is Attorney General Sessions' own denomination, had roughly 600 different clergies and congregations signing a letter wanting to censure him for the use of the Bible and the use of Christian theology to justify these policies. You know, there was a person named Johnny Moore, who's the de facto spokesperson for Trump's evangelical advisors, and he wrote to me in an email that clearly Attorney General Sessions was showing that he was no theologian in his use of the Bible in this way. So I think there was, again, a moment of unity here, the sense that maybe Trump's immigration policies are necessary. Maybe there's a division in how to handle immigration. But ultimately, no one really from any major conservative religious group thought that it's appropriate to justify these family separations with verses from scripture.
Yeah, the Attorney General, Bonnie, seemed to be saying that it's a given that whatever the government decides to do and the law says, that is inherently moral. Is that why the widespread pushback that Emma referenced?
I think it's a big part of it. One of the issues that the United Methodist Church is bringing up, those 600 members are bringing up against Sessions, is that he disseminated doctrine contrary to that of the United Methodist Church. That interpretation of Romans 13 as simply being whatever the government says you need to do. Of course, the pushback from sort of to simplify it that most Christians have been giving is that, you know, you look at the Apostle Paul who wrote that passage. He died being executed by the Roman Empire because they were unhappy with his behavior, and he defied their instructions for him about what to preach. And so I think Christians have long held in intention, yes, we submit to authorities insofar as we can, but there's always this higher loyalty of obeying God rather than man. And Sessions didn't seem to leave any room for that far more important loyalty in his comments.
Bonnie Christian with us, if you've tuned in. She's weekend editor at The Week and the author of A Flexible Faith. And Emma Green with us. She's a staff writer for The Atlantic. We asked our guests to come talk to us about how voters of faith, and I'm, as you hear me saying, a wide spectrum of faith, because sometimes I think these conversations get too narrow on evangelical Christianity, how voters of faith are seeing the political moment that we're in, particularly this issue on immigration and the debate that is going on with President Trump's policies. And I'm asking you, if you're doing some candid thinking about this, I'd love to hear your perspective. Are you finding that your political views on an issue like immigration are at odds or aligned with your religious views and then the leaders of your faith community? Are you reconciling some of the things that your sacred text, whatever it is, says about these issues and the leader of your party or the political leader that you support, what they've been saying? 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, on Twitter, at CarrieNPR, where Mary says, I feel like we're kidding ourselves if we think the president had a personal come-to-Jesus moment after the criticism by faith groups on the separation policy. His motives for the executive order to stop the practice were purely political at the encouragement of advisors. And Wendy says, as a Catholic, I'm grateful for Catholic social teaching and strong quotes our bishops are issuing that are pro-immigrant, pro-migrant. The Bible, the social teachings, and my own political views are aligned. I do wish this political moment in time would pass quickly, though. She brings up a point, Emma, that I wanted to raise before we go back to the calls. Roman Catholic bishops met in Florida last week, and they issued a statement that they see this asylum as a right-to-life issue. Do you get the sense that individual priests are talking to their congregations about this? And what is the meaning overall of the Roman Catholic bishops coming out with a statement like that uses those phrases?
The United States Conference of Catholic Bishops has been issuing a steady drumbeat of statements about the Trump administration's asylum, refugee, and migrant policies. And uniformly, they have used the language of pro-life, pro-family, trying to encourage the unity of the family unit. I spoke a few months back with different parishes that were dealing with the effects of an expired policy that was extended to the citizens of certain Latin American countries who were granted asylum, temporary asylum here in the U.S., mm-hmm. that the Trump administration has sunsetted. And across the board in those local parishes all the way up to the highest national level, there is extreme concern about the effects that these immigration policies will have on families, on children, on people who have been here in the United States for decades, and people who are arriving at the border today. So this has been a consistent theme for Catholic bishops, and I do think it's reflected throughout all levels of Catholic life in America right now.
Call here from Ken in central Minnesota. Hi, Ken. Thanks so much for waiting. I know it's been a while.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm calling, I'm a Christian, and I do believe the Bible teaches us to welcome the stranger and the foreigner and be kind and helpful.
Mm-hmm.
But I also think we would be naive if we just welcomed everyone who came in without properly screening them for their perhaps intent to do us harm. And so I also believe that the government's responsibility, one of their duties, is to protect us. And if that means screening certain people, I believe that that's their duty. And if they can't be properly screened, then they need to be kept from coming in the country.
So, Ken, do you find yourself supporting, it sounds like, the administration's policy on immigration, but then you hear leaders of faith denouncing that policy? So where does that put you?
Well, I think from the Christian perspective, yes, we do want to be welcoming, but we also need to be cautious as to who we welcome so that we are not harmed by those that we welcome and help.
Okay, I appreciate the call. Bonnie, this is what I was hoping for, is some calls from people to say, you know, I'm struggling a bit with this one way or the other. What do you hear in that?
Yeah, I think the idea that Ken brought up, the idea that we have to screen people for intent to do us harm, you know, reasonable people and people of faith can disagree about exactly what level of screening is necessary for safety and what degree of safety we think is possible to achieve. Where a lot of the comments from faith leaders are coming in is really about how we're doing it and what levels of enforcement and what levels of personal suffering for the migrants are tolerable in that process. And so I think that's why the family separation issue in particular has caused so many red flags for so many people who may disagree about, as Ken mentioned, what level of screening is necessary. But we can agree this is not going to be part of it. We don't need to be detaining, you know, children in these conditions with the chain link fences and the Mylar blankets. And so that baseline, I think, is in some ways it's a little bit refreshing to find out, like, that here is something that we can all agree is not okay. And here's something that we can start with. And maybe hopefully we can make some progress from there. Though I do think it'll ultimately be very difficult to resolve opinions that are just frankly different about, you know, what degree of safety is necessary.
You know, Emma, the other thing I was thinking about is how voters of faith are hearing the actual rhetoric that the president uses. I have to say, I recoiled last week when I saw that he used the word infesting in one of his statements about that. I recoil when I hear him talk about everybody as criminals who are trying to come into the country. And I wonder how that's influencing the way faith leaders are reacting to this.
I do think there is a gap between President Trump's choice of rhetoric and at times his posture towards the stranger, the refugee, the asylum seeker, because when it comes down to it, across different religious groups, even those who are the most hardcore anti-immigration, strong borders, pro-wall advocates, nearly all of them also teach this posture of love towards the stranger, of openness, of the dignity of all people, of the worthiness of humans. And so that can be hard for people to take. I do think that even among Trump's strongest supporters, there's often a little bit of chagrin about the way that he may choose to express himself. But that doesn't change the fact that there are some real disagreements here, especially among people in the pews, about the right policy approach to immigration. And I think in equal measure, there are a lot of people, even people of very strong faith, who are frustrated by the demonization that happens of those who might be opponents of open borders or opponents of a permissive immigration policy, seeing it as, you know, attack on them, an attack on them not being able to be real Christians or really having a strong faith because they hold those views.
Phone here from Kate in Medina. Hi, Kate.
Hi. Good morning.
Morning.
My comment is, again, something that I think I'm struggling with, and I'm hoping that your guest might have some insights or thoughts on. But it's what you were just sort of alluding to, in the sense that as Christians, I feel like there's often this going back to the sort of Bible and Christianity basis to help support any of a number of efforts. And what I struggle against is, having been raised as a Christian, you know, I was always taught that all sins are equal, right? There's no greater sin or lesser sin. So how, you know, as Christians, do they sort of use that knowledge to then go after some sins as being seemingly so much bigger or more crucial?
Bonnie, would you tackle that?
Yeah. Well, so I would say is that in terms of our need for atonement and our need for reconciliation with God, Christians will say, and I've heard that phrase as well, it's a little bit glib, but the idea that all sins are equal and all sins are equally breaking of that relationship. That said, in terms of consequences that different sins have right now, and especially consequences that they have for other people, in this case for these immigrant children, sins have different consequences, and so they are in that sense not equal. So to say, I think we have to make that distinction and to recognize that, you know, something like a murder is going to have very different consequences than a white lie, even though we would count them both as sins and theologically, in some sense, level the playing field between the two.
Marty says, called in to say, I was raised ELCA Lutheran. I considered myself a conservative Christian, but it turns out that means me and other believers are very socially liberal. I think that other Christians who are conservative Christians assume that means they're conservative politically. Lynn says, I was raised Catholic. We were told you will know that you're a Christian by your love. All of this support for a hateful president is baffling to me. Denise says, I'm a Unitarian Universalist. We're called to bring more love into the world. We need to protect Muslim people's rights and support the poor. We need more kindness and love. I think that the policy at the border is just a cover for white supremacy. And to Nancy in St. Paul. Hi, Nancy. You're a Buddhist. Is that right?
I am.
We have run the spectrum. I'm thrilled with the people that have called. Tell me how you're here in this discussion.
Well, in Buddhism, we're called to hold all beings, people, animals, insects, even with compassion, and to extend loving kindness toward them. And so what's been happening these past few weeks with the children being separated from their parents, you know, it's heartbreaking. And so my effort is to, you know, extend loving kindness toward them. It's essentially praying for their well-being, their safety, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, we're also supposed to have these same sorts of feelings toward quote-unquote, difficult people.
Mm-hmm.
And that would include, you know, the president in terms of, his actions on these issues, and also the people who are supporting those actions.
So there's where your test, there's where the challenge is for you in this moment, yes?
Yeah, but what I try to do is remember that people who seem to have that much anger and are acting in such a way, they're usually scared. And if I try to, you know, hold them with that thought in my mind, then I can extend loving kindness toward them as well and just hope that they'll come around.
I'm glad to have your call. Thank you. Kate says on Twitter, I feel like evangelicals have hijacked the term Christian. I've noticed I'm now a little hesitant to say that I'm Christian, or I prejudge someone who starts out by saying they're Christian. It's so unfortunate. It might be similar to how some Republicans feel about what Trump, in her view, has changed or hijacked the Republican Party. Emma, what do you think about that? And I have to say, this is why I specified. I want to hear from a lot of people from a lot of different faiths, including Christians who don't identify as evangelical Christians. Does Kate have a point?
There's been a name debate raging across different groups, and this is especially acute among evangelical Christians. For example, at Princeton, a longstanding student group that had the name Evangelical in its Christian Evangelical Fellowship decided to drop the word evangelical because they thought it was too negatively associated. I think it's a little bit less common for this to be extended all the way to the term Christian. And what I've heard more frequently is people who formerly would have said, I'm an evangelical, may identify more simply as a follower of Jesus or as a Christian, plain and simple. But in general, I think this goes back to the theme, which is that We're in a time of division and fracture and exhaustion and alienation, and the way that people publicly identify themselves religiously often carries a pretty heavy political freight as well.
Good point. You know, Bonnie, I think a lot of political analysts have been trying to understand what the steadiness of the support is for the president from evangelicals. And I wondered, is it because his political policies match their political views? Is it because he promised to deliver a Supreme Court justice and he did? I mean, what would you say is the source of the constant and rising support among evangelicals? Help us understand it.
I think the policies are a big part of it. The Supreme Court certainly is a big part of it. Just today, in addition to the Muslim ban case, there was another decision about crisis pregnancy centers in California, I believe, that had previously been required to tell their patients about abortion services available, and the conservative majority said, you know, as a free speech issue, you can't compel this speech. And that's the sort of religious liberty triumph that many conservatives and evangelicals who supported Trump were hoping to see. That said, I do think that some of this support endures sort of regardless of the policy outcomes. You know, the Trump administration has experienced a lot of policy frustrations, and many things that he has promised haven't been delivered yet.
Right.
And I think that it persists significantly because there's a perception that Trump is in there fighting for them. And I've heard, you know, various evangelical leaders speaking out about this. You hear phrases like, you know, we didn't elect a Sunday school teacher. We wanted, you know, the toughest guy in there to be on our side. And now it feels at least like he is.
This is kind of the persecution element of this, as in everybody's against us. We need somebody to be our ally. And we see him as somebody who, against all the odds, fights on our behalf. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's very interesting to watch because of the sort of deep mismatch between his, you know, personal behavior and language and manner. And again, the lack of achievement on some of these policy things. And yet that support remains, I think, significantly because of that perception you're describing of a hero has emerged and we're going to embrace him.
Emma, I've got about 90 seconds. Would love to hear you on that.
I do think that the widespread perception, especially among politically engaged white evangelicals, is that Trump has emerged as the strong champion of their policy priorities when it comes to religious liberty, to abortion and pro-life issues. But I wouldn't underplay the degree to which this administration and this political era more broadly has deeply, deeply divided evangelicals and more broadly people of faith across generational lines, across gender lines. I have been following a number of people who were deeply disturbed by President Trump's comments about women in the Access Hollywood video and have just continued to feel that way, who look around at the rhetoric that emerged after the Charlottesville attacks and other incidents and really feel a sense of profound alienation and regret about the way that their religious fellows have been moving. So this is at once an era of unity, but it's also an era of division.
Emma, really good to have you on the show. Thanks much.
Thanks so much.
And Bonnie, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
More discussion and analysis of the Supreme Court decisions today. And by the way, on All Things Considered, I should say that. And by the way, still waiting for the U.S. Supreme Court to announce its decision on that union case. And when it does, we'll cover it.
This was a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to our discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828 or tweet Kerri at KERRINPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all of our shows by subscribing to this podcast. If you have questions, you can email us at talk@npr.org.